Hello and welcome to the very first Blockchain.com podcast. My name is Garrett Kyleman. I'm the head of research at Blockchain.com and a visiting fellow at the London School of Economics. Ethereum and DeFi, which is shorthand for decentralized finance, have been generating tremendous excitement in recent months. But how much true innovation is behind all the DeFi buzz? And should we be worried about another 2017 ICO-style mania and bubble? To answer these and other Ethereum questions, we're excited to share with you a recent conversation that Blockchain.com co-founder Nick Carey and I had with Anthony Sassano. Anthony is the co-founder of ETHHub.io and the author of the Daily Gwei newsletter, two excellent resources for anyone interested in staying on top of what's happening with Ethereum and DeFi. Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy our conversation with Anthony. So, without any further ado, it's our privilege here to bring Anthony now into the conversation. As Nick mentioned, we're big, big fans of Anthony's newsletter, daily reading for myself and for others, and very excited to talk with him about the world of Ethereum and DeFi. Anthony, welcome.
Hey guys. Hey, everyone. Thank you for having me.
Great. Well, we're thrilled to have you here. I think we've got a few kind of questions that we wanted to lead things off with, and then we were going to open it up for some questions from the audience as well. Nick, did you want to just start off with a couple of your questions before I jump in? Great.
So thanks for being up really early. I think it's 1:03 in the morning, or maybe 2 where Anthony is. So crypto never sleeps, and that's greatest community members are awake at all hours for the cause. So thanks for your time. Anthony was really kind about a month and a half ago, spent almost an hour helping me get up to speed on what's going on specifically within the Ethereum community, and also helping me better understand what's going on with something you may have heard about called DeFi. And so no stupid questions today, and we encourage anyone that has questions to definitely submit them, and we'll work to get those to Anthony in a succinct way. So DeFi or decentralized finance is making a lot of headlines right now, Anthony, and I think it might be helpful to define a few terms. You know, finance in general can be sort of intimidating. And so, you know, can you help us better understand what is DeFi and how is it different from everything else that's going on in crypto? I mean, people may have only heard about Bitcoin, they're learning about Ethereum, and now there's a lot of hashtags and people talking about DeFi. So, you know, maybe put those three things in context for us and we can start there.
Yeah, sure. So I guess the easiest way to explain it to people who may not be familiar with it is that I guess if you think about Bitcoin as a decentralized asset, you can think of decentralized finance as decentralizing everything else. It's got to do with finance, right? You know, there's a bunch of different things being rebuilt on Ethereum, like your classic financial instruments, like lending and derivatives and everything like that, and trying to decentralize this out. I try to compare it usually to, I guess, the traditional finance system. And people ask me, they're like, isn't fintech doing this? You know, the technology that's coming, the traditional finance system and improving that for a lot of people. But I kind of push back on that because fintech is just building on the old rails that we already have, right? All these old systems that have been around for decades that are still quite slow. And it's just like putting band-aids on and trying to improve it. Whereas with, you know, decentralized finance on Ethereum, we're rebuilding this from the ground up. We're rebuilding the rails that you can build these things on in a kind of global manner, in an internet first manner. So yeah, I mean, comparing it to Bitcoin again, Bitcoin is like, you know, classically referred to as the internet of money. You know, you send Bitcoin across globally, you can send it like really fast. You just have to wait for a block to kind of confirm. Whereas DeFi on Ethereum is basically decentralizing everything else, making everything else globally available, finance globally available to everyone, no matter where they are, as long as they have an internet connection. So I guess that's what people are most excited about, is the fact that we basically took the concept and the idea that came with Bitcoin and applied it to like everything else got to do with finance.
Great. That definitely helps me better understand it. And I'm going to probably borrow some of those metaphors. So I will credit you, but thank you. So we hear now a good deal about DeFi tokens. Can you walk us through what those are, what kind of the incentive mechanism they provide, and maybe give us an example of one or two and the differences between them? You know, the community members in crypto certainly had a large number of different assets put in front of them with varying degrees of, I would say, credibility. And so help us better understand what's going on specifically on the token offerings within DeFi and what the product market fit is for those.
Yeah, I think the best way to frame it is that people might be familiar with a lot of the tokens that were around in 2017, right? We had the ICO boom on Ethereum. A lot of these tokens were issued and many of them were actually useless things. They didn't do anything, right? You didn't have like governance rights to the project. You didn't have like a right to the fees. You know, the tokens were commonly referred to as futility tokens because they didn't do anything. Whereas these DeFi tokens that are kind of emerging and that have grown so much lately, they actually do give you rights within a system. So for example, these different protocols on Ethereum, these different DeFi protocols, as I spoke about, like lending protocol, there's one for lending, there's like Compound and Aave, there's also derivative protocols. They tend to have their own token associated with them. And the whole point of this token is to basically decentralize the management of the protocol through governance rights that the token holders have over the protocol and, you know, other things like the rights to the fees in the protocol. Sometimes the tokens are used as an insurance for the protocol itself. So if for some reason the protocol loses money or it becomes under collateralized or something like that, then the token can make up for that and act as like an insurance vehicle there. So I think most of the tokens that we're seeing within DeFi tokens have those two baselines, the governance rights and a right to the fees generated by the protocol. But there's a lot of experimentation still going on. There's different tokens experimenting with different ways to capture value. Some of them can be used as collateral within their own system. So there's a project called Synthetics, which is like a synthetic asset platform. You can actually use the SNX token of the synthetic asset platform to mint these synthetic assets. So you use that as the collateral to mint them. You know, that token will also have governance rights over the platform. It also has, once you add it as collateral, you also have a right to the fees. So they actually have fundamental value now. It's not just these useless tokens that were issued and no one, you know, you can't do anything with them within the projects that they were issued by. So I think that's like a surface level about why people are so excited about it. The other side of it, and this is probably getting a bit into the weeds, but the other side of it is that these tokens act as a beacon for the community to rally around, right? So if you buy a token for this protocol, then you are immediately aligned with it. Just like if you buy Bitcoin, you are immediately aligned with Bitcoin, right? You want Bitcoin to go up. You want Bitcoin adoption to increase. You're incentivized to spread the good word of Bitcoin, for example. That's the same thing with these DeFi tokens. You know, and it's always funny to me when I look at that, because like if I buy a stock, like Tesla or Apple, like I'm not going around evangelizing that to everyone, right? Like I would Ethereum or some of these DeFi tokens. So that's where it's really unique to me, is that you can build an army of people around your project and give them real ownership over it as well, and a real say, just by having these tokens that are basically as free flowing on Ethereum as, you know, ETH is, or as Bitcoin is on Bitcoin.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest, there's this meme in crypto called the flippening. And it's always meant something a little bit different depending on who you're talking to. And certainly in the Ethereum community, there's, I would say, a hopeful anticipation of a flippening where the total value of the Ethereum network kind of absorbs the value of maybe some of the other dominant crypto protocols. And so how does DeFi, in your view, challenge the business models in crypto, period? Like, what do you see changing there? And how should exchanges and wallets and lending businesses be thinking about the fundamentals of their business model in this era?
I think it fundamentally changes what these services are. So traditionally, these centralized services, like centralized exchanges, all of them will have been like, I guess, the one-stop shop for a lot of these tokens, right? You basically buy, you know, in the earlier days, you'd have to buy BTC, or I mean, maybe not so much ETH, but you'd have to buy BTC and then trade that for another one of these tokens, right? But now I guess you can use like direct fiat to a lot of these tokens as well. But the amazing thing, and what I've noticed recently, is that like these tokens get issued on Ethereum, right? For a project, they instantly start trading on Ethereum because Ethereum has decentralized exchanges on it. And then the centralized exchanges are actually the ones who lag to list this asset, right? We've seen this play out with Binance recently. They're like, you know, obviously the biggest exchange still, I'm pretty sure, centralized exchange. But they're rushing to list these things after they've already traded the hundreds of millions of dollars worth of volume a day on Ethereum, on these decentralized exchanges. So basically DeFi is now becoming the leader and that whole space over the centralized space, and they're playing catch up. Whereas previously, the centralized space would lead because you'd hope that your token would be listed on this exchange, right? And that it would go up in value because of that. But now you don't have to do that anymore. The YFI token, for example, the one that blockchain.com just listed, that was available on Ethereum. I think it's only 2 months old, but that did its entire run up to a $1 billion cap, mostly just through Ethereum decentralized exchanges, which is, you know, fundamentally different to what we've had seen in the past with a lot of these things.
Yeah, it's pretty astonishing. Well, definitely something to keep an eye on as we running custodial, non-custodial and lending services here. So I'll pass it over to Garrick. I know he's put a lot of time thinking some questions. So yeah.
Thanks, Nick. So Anthony, I just want to start off with, again, mentioning the newsletter because it is such an incredible resource. And it's wonderful also for people who've been in the crypto space for a number of years to see all these great, reliable sources of information and insights in the space. Now, that wasn't the case necessarily years ago. And I want to really direct the community to your newsletter. Can you tell us about it, including how to pronounce, for those who are new to Ethereum, the title, what the motivation for starting it was, who the audience is, et cetera?
Yeah, for sure. Well, thank you for the kind words for starters on that. So yeah, the newsletter is called The Daily Gwei. It's a daily newsletter covering basically everything happening in Ethereum or the top things happening in Ethereum for the day. And I guess the reason it's called The Daily Gwei is because on Ethereum, there's obviously you have to pay fees to transact on the network. And these fees are commonly referred to as gas fees or Gwei. Gwei is like the, without getting too technical, Gwei is one part of the gas fees transaction there. So that's why it's called The Daily Gwei. I started this newsletter about probably 2 or 3 months ago now. And I basically did it as a way to get my kind of knowledge out there because I spend so much time in the Ethereum space. You know, I talk to so many different people about things, like so many smart people about things, and they help me to synthesize my views on things. And I figured that why not, you know, give this information out to the world? Like there's so much value here that I could be giving to people and using my platform for more than, you know, just posting snarky tweets. But in addition to that, I also wanted to start writing a lot more. And I figured the best way to keep myself motivated to keep writing is to make a promise to like thousands of people that I'm going to write something every day. And that has worked because I have not missed one. It's every weekday. I have not missed one weekday since I started. 77 issues straight so far. 71 issues straight so far. So yeah, that was kind of the main motivations for creating it.
Great. I just want to go back to kind of the start of the DeFi boom a few months back. You know, DeFi has been out for a while, but it really went into overdrive this spring. Talk us through, you know, how that happened. And, you know, I think you already touched on some of the innovation that is occurring. This isn't just, you know, old hype, but kind of walk through some of the innovations and that kicking off of the DeFi boom to where we are today.
Yeah. So I guess if we were to trace back DeFi's roots, I guess the first protocol that we referred to as like part of the DeFi umbrella would have been MakerDAO and the DAI stablecoin, which went live December of 2017. Now, obviously, for those who were around in 2017, DeFi wasn't a thing. And even when Maker launched, DeFi wasn't like a thing. The term DeFi wasn't around. There was none of what we have today. Fast forward since then, it has been growing really slowly since then. I think also because we had the bear market through 2018 and 2019, you know, the protocols were getting built and all this magic was happening. But because the market was cold, people weren't, you know, so fast to put their money into things, right? And to put their fresh money into things as well. And everyone was hurting and everyone was bleeding. And, you know, the bear market, I guess, technically stopped at the end of last year where, you know, we had that final kind of, I guess, capitulation. And then from there, we started trending up again. And, you know, we trended up until, I guess, COVID happened and we had like a pause for a bit, but we're back on the uptrend. So I think that's helped considerably with the growth of these things, but they have actually been around for, I guess, a couple of years now. And in terms of like the exponential growth that we've seen, I think in June was when Compound launched what is now known as yield farming, if you've heard of that. They basically popularized this in June because Compound is a lending protocol on Ethereum. They have their own token called Comp. Now, what they did was to distribute this token is they're paying this token out to people who provide liquidity to the Compound platform. So if you go there and put in your ETH or put in your stable coins, they will pay you some amount of comp depending on how much you put in for doing that. Similarly, they'll pay you comp for withdrawing assets and borrowing assets too. And when I say they, I mean the smart contract system. This is all decentralized. It's not like the Compound company is paying you. It's all decentralized. You claim the assets yourself. You do it all yourself. And since then, it's kind of been a Cambrian explosion of this yield farming thing that we often hear about, where different protocols are paying out their native token for people to provide liquidity. So I think that's the main reason why we've seen it go from, I think it was $1 billion locked just a few months ago to like $9 or $10 billion today. But yeah, I think it was all there. Like all the ingredients were there. The market was better. Like this wouldn't have worked in a bear market, for example, right? You know, it needed those kind of ingredients to be ready. So that's why I think we've seen the exponential growth. And now obviously more people are coming into the space and seeing the value in it. And we're having like this pace of development where we're packing hundreds of years of financial kind of innovation into like months, which is quite insane.
Great. That history is, I think, really helpful, especially for folks who are just getting into this. So, you know, one thing, you know, we wrote about recently is kind of a comparison of lending markets and DeFi and kind of what we call digital asset lending platforms like ourselves, like, you know, BlockFi and some others, you know, looking at the interest rates over the past 12 to 18 months on Compound for a while, we were seeing double digit interest rates and then those compressed and they have driven people more towards the digital asset lending platforms, which offered arguably an easier user experience, more predictable rates, higher rates even. But with yield farming, as you mentioned, it's made the returns quite compelling on the DeFi side of things. And I just wanted to ask you about kind of the user experience, the user interface, where that's at today. You know, for people who are new to crypto and DeFi, is owning Ethereum the best way to gain exposure, or are there still relatively easier ways to gain access to this? And where does the user experience stand and how does it become even easier for people?
Yeah, so the beautiful thing about Ethereum is that you only need ETH to get started. So if you've got some ETH, you pay transaction fees in ETH as well, just like you would pay transaction fees in Bitcoin on the Bitcoin network. So yeah, you just buy some ETH with your fiat money and then you can, you know, withdraw it to your wallet, usually something called MetaMask for people that are familiar with that. Or there's a bunch of other mobile wallets you can play around with too, but MetaMask is the most popular desktop wallet. It's like a Chrome extension. And in terms of, I guess, the general UI UX, I think it's really good. I actually think it's better than the traditional system already. When I log into my bank account, I hate it because there's so much redundant stuff going on there. There's so many wait times and I see all these notes about things and it's so confusing and I log off, right? I'm just like, I don't want to deal with this anymore. And then I go on to Ethereum and within minutes, I am lending my assets on Compound, right? Or I'm borrowing assets from Compound or one of the other protocols. I'm trading my ETH for a stablecoin like DAI or USDC, right? I'm providing liquidity for decentralized exchanges from any number of assets, right? And yes, the UI UX is still clunky for some of these apps. There's a bunch of jargon, like, you know, DAI, for example, like it's popular, but people still, when I say DAI, they're like, oh, what's DAI? Then I have to explain how DAI is a stablecoin. And they're like, what's a stablecoin? So I think the jargon is still there. The UI UX is clunky for some of the apps, but you know, something like, I know I keep referring to it, but something like Compound, just, it's a very slick UI. You know, I work at Set and we make a product called Token Sets. And that's to me very slick as well. So I just think that we're already ahead of where the traditional finance system is. I just think we have to refine those words so that we kind of remove the jargon and just say to people, hey, you can upload your dollars to Ethereum and earn a better interest rate than you could in your bank account. Just give them what they want, right? And give them a nice interface to do that. And that's actually going back to what we spoke about before. That's where I think centralized services can still play a role here, where they can actually sit on top of these decentralized protocols and take in the user assets and then lend them out, right, for them, on behalf of them. Take their cut or whatever, take their convenience fee, just like these centralized exchanges take their convenience fee for being a fiat on-ramp these days. So that's another angle that I am hoping to see more of. And we're already seeing exchanges do this and other services do this.
That's great. Nick, I just want to make sure we allow enough time for any questions that are coming in from the community. I certainly have a lot more I could tee up for Anthony, but do we want to take some of those questions?
We've got a few people, Anthony, that are following the DeFi stuff carefully and probably benefit from your perspective on things. I think probably one of the most urgent ones would be to quickly summarize the sushi swap saga and drama going on there. One person referred to it as, what are the benefits for DeFi from sushi vampire attack on Uniswap liquidity? Sorry to add the crypto jargon, but for those that know, they know. Can you give us a little rundown on what happened there?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to try and explain the whole thing because that'll take me a long time and there's so much to cover here. I guess the simplest way I can explain it is that there's a protocol called Uniswap on Ethereum that is a decentralized exchange. Another kind of project came along called SushiSwap. It basically copied Uniswap exactly. It pretty much is the exact same thing as Uniswap, but added a token. So Uniswap doesn't have a token and SushiSwap does. So, and as I mentioned before, with the yield farming stuff, you can pay out your token for people providing liquidity. So that's what SushiSwap did. They said, put your liquidity here. Actually, I'm going to get technical here, but they basically said, put the liquidity that you're providing to Uniswap in SushiSwap, right? And this was a calculated move, because what ended up happening is these people are earning sushi, right? They're actually getting some really nice gains from this, from providing the liquidity. And then the end plan was to basically, as was alluded to, do this vampire attack where they actually stole the liquidity from Uniswap and put it onto the SushiSwap exchange through a migration process. So, you know, this is getting very in the weeds of things, but I think the main takeaway from this is that liquidity is not a moat on Ethereum. Just because your protocol has $1 billion locked in it one day, it can be gone the next. This happened in a week. SushiSwap went from nothing to $1.3 billion in a week, right? And then it took that with it when it created its own exchange, which is basically a clone of Uniswap. It took that directly from Uniswap to their own exchange. So it questions, what is the moat, right? Like, how do you defend your protocol against these vampire attacks? Can this just keep happening? Is there diminishing returns here from doing this all the time? And, you know, SushiSwap has gone on and over the last day has actually done as much trading volume as Uniswap has. And Uniswap's been around for years. And one funny thing about this SushiSwap thing is that the creator of it assigned 10% of the tokens to himself. Then on the weekend, he sold it all, right? Basically for like $15 million in a week and vanished. And then handed control of the protocol over to the FTX founder, Sam Bankman-Fried, for those who know him. And he's been kind of like taking the reins since then. But it's just insane. Like this is something that I think is going to influence how everyone develops their protocols now on Ethereum and their projects, because you've got to be scared of that, right? You've got to be scared of you build this thing for 3 years, 4 years, right? You deploy it, right? You've got all this cool tech that you spent so long on. And then someone comes along, copies all your code because it's all open source, right? Copies everything, shoves in yield farming program with a token, pays people to move. And because liquidity can move so fast across Ethereum, you just don't have a moat. So that's the main takeaways, I think, from the whole saga.
Interesting. The drama is always fresh and distinct. I think crypto pushes innovation in really remarkable ways, and the businesses are always under attack in different ways, but this also creates interesting outcomes. They're basically one of the most adversarial markets ever. So imitation is the highest form of flattery, they say. I think it can also be quite painful if you vocationally spent 3 years building something, have someone come Xerox it and take it from you, basically. So it's going to be interesting to see how that develops. But, you know, with each one of those episodes, you get different incentives to build more resilient incentive structures and architectures. So it's savage, but it probably leads to better outcomes in the long run. Let's see. How would you comment quickly on the dangerous rise, I would say, on the fees in Ethereum really have clogged up the network. And for those that don't know, you know, fees on cryptocurrency networks are a way to incentivize mining as well as other incentives. And when there's a lot of people using a network, there can be congestion, and it can also cause fees to rise, which means the utility of the network gets diminished. And so I think, you know, Bitcoin has multiple occasions had significant eras where there have been very high fees that lead to diminishing utility of the protocol, arguably. And Ethereum is now having a similar situation, mostly driven, I think, by all the DeFi activity. So what is the plan there? What's your view on that? I mean, it's obviously a sort of an endorsement of this is how useful and valuable the network is, that there's so many people on top of it, but it's a double-edged sword, because if it's not useful or it's pricing people out, that's also a problem. So what do you think is the viable pathway there?
Yeah, this is a hot topic in Ethereum and a hot debate. I generally take the side that on the short to medium term, high fees are very good for Ethereum. And that might be an unpopular opinion, but I've written about this before in my newsletter, but the main reason is because it pushes innovation on scaling, right? So if fees are really low, no one's kind of motivated to scale, right? They're just like, well, the fees are low. Why do we need to kind of scale? Why do we need to build these new technologies to scale, right? We'll worry about that when the time comes. Well, the time has come, right? The fees are very high because of the fact that, one, as you said, Nick, there's value there. The people are doing valuable things on the network, and it's worth their time to do it and their money to do it. And secondly, it's because any rational economic actor is going to pay the fees as long as they're making more than what they're paying in the fees. So if they're paying $500 even to get into a yield farm, but over the course of a few hours, they're able to make that back and then profit, then you would do it. I do stuff like this too, right? And a lot of people in the Ethereum space that I know, they do this. And for me, when I look at those fees, I don't even blink anymore. I just pay them because I know that the outcome is going to be profitable. But on the flip side, there's a lot of people that have been priced out now, right? If you don't have lots and lots of money for these things, then you're not going to be able to afford the fees. Even sending like a transaction is still cheap, but it's not as cheap as it can be. It's like a couple of dollars sometimes, depending on what you're sending. And that's where Ethereum, I guess, differs from Bitcoin too, in that different actions cost different amounts of money. So if you're just sending ETH across the network, it's cheap. If you're just sending a token, it's a bit more expensive, but still relatively cheap. But if you're doing the stuff I talk about, like if you're doing DeFi stuff, you're interacting with the smart contracts now, and you're interacting with more complex transactions, that's what's going to cost you a lot more money. So that's what most of the network is doing. But yeah, I guess there's a great blog post that I base a lot of my thinking on from Union Square Ventures that basically says that the infrastructure phase is a myth. The infrastructure doesn't come first, right? What comes first is the demand and the apps and the usage. And then we build the infrastructure after it. And you see that play out in the real world too, right? I don't know how it is in the US, but around me, they always build the houses first. They don't build the train stations, right? They build the houses, people move in, and they build the shops. They build the train stations, they build the schools and everything, right? And then everything goes up. But for the people that first move there, there's pain because they've got to drive a longer distance to get to the shops. They have to drive to work because there's no train station, there's no buses, right? And that's just like what we are like on Ethereum today. We're the first settlers, basically. We're the pioneers, right? We've come in, it's hard. It's a long way to go. We have to develop what we've come into, but eventually it gets better. And that's what I'm kind of betting on with it. I'm betting on that Ethereum can scale through both ETH2, which people have heard about, obviously, and through layer two scaling on top of Ethereum. And we've already seen this explode over the last few months. We've seen more layer two innovation and development and deployment than any other time in Ethereum's history. And, you know, ETH2 is going to take a little bit longer, but while we have like Ethereum as it is today, we can scale via layer two. And now it just takes the projects adopting this, which they are slowly. So I think over the next few months, we'll see this happen. The fees will probably stay the same, but be high, but users will be interacting on layer two, and that's how they'll save on fees. And one other thing I wanted to say, I know I'm rambling here, but this is really important. With Ethereum now, we're actually seeing these things pop up which pull capital together in a non-custodial way. So I mentioned the YFI token before. That token is part of the Yearn platform. Now, what the Yearn platform does is a bunch of different things. One of its killer products are called vaults. So what these vaults do is it basically pulls all the capital together. So you can have 1,000 people put in $100 each for this isn't expensive to do. It's a few dollars to do, right? And then once the money's in there, it's pulled together. So then that pool of funds will go and chase yield on Ethereum, right? And go yield farm together and as part of one whole thing, instead of 1,000 users making 1,000 transactions to do yield farming. So it's like you're scaling up by pooling this capital together. And that actually is an underappreciated aspect, I think, because just think about how many transactions can be offloaded to just that pool.
That's shared transaction, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, that's pretty cool. So we just have about another 5 minutes and wanted to see if there was anything else, Garrick, you'd maybe wanted to summarize or wrap up with.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned ETH 2.0, Anthony, and the transition to proof of stake and the opportunity to stake ETH. Can you talk a bit about that, the 32 ETH staking minimum, and maybe touch on what that means for security and staking as a service, just to try to look further ahead beyond the current DeFi boom to what's coming down, maybe later this year or next year, hopefully.
Yeah. So the ETH2 rollout is being done in phases, and maybe many people aren't aware of this, but I guess what everyone's talking about going live, hopefully at the end of this year, is the first phase, and it's codenamed phase zero. This is the phase where you'll be able to send your ETH to the new ETH2 chain. So it's being deployed as a new blockchain, and you'll be able to stake it there. And that's all you'll be able to do in phase zero, just stake and earn a return denominated in ETH. And also you can't send your ETH back at the moment to ETH1. So it's a one-way bridge, which opens up like a whole different can of worms for how exchanges are going to handle this, right? And with exchange staking, I don't actually think the top exchanges are going to be doing phase zero staking. I mean, by top, I mean like the Coinbases, right? The professionalized ones that are more, I guess, like in the US, not like offshore and things like that. Because there are ways to do it where you can make derivatives of the token and trade those. But yeah, I mean, without getting too much off track there, phase zero, end of this year, you can send your ETH and stake there. As you said, 32 ETH is the minimum to be your own staker, but there's going to be staking pools just like there's mining pools. So if you only have like 10 ETH, then you can basically pool it together with someone else and a bunch of other people to meet that minimum. And then you can stake. People who are familiar with proof of stake at this point, probably familiar with something like Tezos or Polkadot or Cosmos, which is delegated proof of stake. It's different. It's when you literally just put your tokens in. It's usually on exchange. You put it in and then you let the exchange take care of it all for you, right? That will be able to happen in ETH2 as well. But the difference with ETH2 is that anyone can be their own staker with or without the minimum. So you can run the staking software on your own computer and your own home. Like I've got my own dedicated computer for this and I'm running like the test nets on it and things like that. And it's not beefy. It's not like a miner. You don't need beefy hardware or anything like that. You just need like some simple hardware. You can even run it on a Raspberry Pi, I think, in the first phase. Anyway, and then you'll be able to stake on your own. Whereas with these other protocols, you don't really have that option. You have to delegate your stake, essentially. So that's what's coming with phase zero. And then we have phase one, which comes after that, which for people who have heard about sharding. So the shard chains that will connect to the... I forgot to say the phase zero brings with it that what's called the beacon chain, which is basically the staking chain. And then the shard chains will connect to this beacon chain. So that's what's coming in phase one. And then we have phase 1.5, which is when ETH1 gets merged into ETH2. So it becomes a shard of ETH2. And then phase two is when we get basically full smart contract capability across all the shards for what's called state execution. So you can actually do transactions and things like that. So it is a kind of like a complicated roadmap if you want to dig really deep into it and how it all works. But it's going to take probably a couple of years to get this all out there. But I think for most people, the only thing you really need to be concerned about is, do you want to stake? Yes. Okay. Well, there's guides already out for how to do this and everything. You can Google search the Ethereum Launchpad, I think it is, or Ethereum Foundation Launchpad, and that'll guide you through it when it goes live. Don't you want to stake? Well, if you don't want to stake and you just want to be on Ethereum, you just have to basically do nothing, because once that merger happens with ETH1 into ETH2, you ideally, I mean, if everything goes well, which we hope it does, you won't feel a thing. Basically, you'll just be part of the ETH2 kind of network now. The network will feel the same to you because we're preserving the ETH1 network, but it's just going to be secured by the proof of stake chain instead of what we have today with mining. So that's like the whole roadmap there. If you want to read more about it, there's plenty of resources online. You can search ETH2 phases and it will come up with resources. But yeah, it's pretty exciting in my mind, because ETH2's like the staking that they're trying to do in the whole architecture is very different to what the other protocols are doing, in that to me, the other protocols are taking trade-offs where they're taking shortcuts and using this delegated proof of stake mechanism. Whereas with, as I explained with ETH2, they're using like a self-sovereign kind of staking mechanism where you can stake on your own or you can stake with an exchange if you want to.
Great. That was brilliantly succinct for something so complicated. One last question, if we can, Nick, and you started to touch on this, so it's a good way, I think, to wrap up. And I know you probably get this question a lot, and you know, the challengers to Ethereum, you know, the other protocols that are trying to beat Ethereum, you know, what would it take to beat Ethereum? And maybe you could talk a bit about the Ethereum community here at this point too, and how that plays into kind of Ethereum's moat and its advantage.
So I'm a strong believer in that if you don't have a community, you're not going to even touch Ethereum. Like very, very strong believer in that. Just like with Bitcoin, right? No one can touch Bitcoin because their community is so big, right? So large, so feverish. It's the same with Ethereum. So that's the first thing you need to do to come at Ethereum. You need to have a really good community who cares deeply about the project, right? And about what the vision is, and have kind of an ideological view of where they want kind of this thing to go. And that's what a lot of the people in Ethereum have. That's what I have. That's what I'm here for. Like I'm aligned with the Ethereum vision, which is to decentralize everything basically. And then on top of that, you kind of need to basically build everything that Ethereum's built at this point. You need to build all the DeFi stuff from scratch, right? You need to have all the assets as well. Like the assets are the most important thing, I think. in that all these assets that people want to trade are on Ethereum right now. And any of the ones that are not on Ethereum are being tokenized on Ethereum. Like Bitcoin is being tokenized on Ethereum at a rapid pace because people want to use their Bitcoin to do things, but they can't do that on the Bitcoin network, right? So they come to Ethereum and they do it on there. So that will be the second most important thing, I think, is the assets. And this all plays into the network effects, right? You know, dev tooling, developing on Ethereum in general is a lot easier than probably other platforms because say you've got a question about something that you Google search for, you're more than likely to get an answer to it on Ethereum. But if you're developing on one of these new chains, you're probably not going to get an answer to it from Google. You're going to have to go into the channels and speak to someone directly and the response might be slower and everything like that. So you just default to that as well. But I think from the conversations I've had with people in Ethereum and what it would take for an Ethereum to change, right? It would have to be one of two things. It would have to be a shift in kind of what these other platforms are doing in terms of their ideologies and their goals and their vision. The other platform would have to basically be as decentralized as Ethereum, which none of them are objectively at this point. I'm talking smart contract, not including Bitcoin in this. And they would have to have the ethos and the spirit of Ethereum, where I don't think any of these others do right now, because Ethereum has a long and colored history as well, which plays into things. So it's kind of like changing cultures to an extent, right? If you were born and raised in one culture and then you try to go and change into another one, it's very hard. And most people don't do that because it's hard and it's alien. It doesn't align with who you are. And you can even compare it to a religion too, right? Imagine changing like your faith or what you follow. It's very hard. And that's what these are to me as well. It's pretty much at that level in people's minds, I think. So yeah, without, I guess that's maybe a different answer than you'll get from other people. But for me, who spent so much time in this whole space, community, yeah, and all that stuff that surrounds community is what you need to even scratch Ethereum. And right now, the other platforms can't even come at Ethereum because they're all fighting each other too, right? For a chance to be number two. Like if I asked anyone, what's number two to Ethereum, right? You'll get different answers from everyone. You won't get the same answer. So until you can actually get the same answer from multiple different people, then I don't think anything can come close to Ethereum at this point.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Anthony. I think we'll let you get a few hours of sleep. Surely you'll need those to maintain the stamina long-term. We really appreciate your time today and always value your insights. Please look up Anthony's newsletter, subscribe to that. We'll put a link into the description of this so that people can find it, Anthony. And so everyone, thank you very much. We'll be uploading this to YouTube, to Facebook, and we'll be announcing also a podcast soon. So stay tuned. And we'll catch you next month. Thank you, everyone, for joining us again. Have a wonderful morning, afternoon, or evening. Cheers.
Thanks, everyone.